everybody here is employed by the survey, or except adults and child, who once were and have a very honorable record. So we have to include them. But this is a survey party. Even some of you have noticed that in those late years, I am inclined to reminisce. Well, I admit the charge before you make it. I was reading in the paper the other day, you know these doctor's columns? Doctors give free advice about them. Somebody asked concerning their parents, what are the evidences of senility? And they said, the doctor replied, why, the tendencies of them is. Now, maybe I ought to call our old friend Patrick Henry. Remember Patrick Henry said, with this piece of liberty, let us make the most of it. Well, some of us thought and took this idea up. With this crop, there are several crops of survey here. May I say generations? Adolph and Frank really, well, he started in 1901, that's only 61 years ago. Adolph, 1911. Now then, there's a lapse up to about Bill Pierce and Phil King generation. 1928, Bill, 28 times, Phil King, 30. But most of you that are here start around 40. Ward starts 38. Anyhow, it seemed to me, looking for some sort of amusement or gaiety, that it might be worthwhile if Frank and Adolph and I look back on the old days in the survey, not so much to look at the purely professional activities and attainments, but to look at these men that were running the survey and that I've chosen 1910, 50 years ago. Now, briefly with regard to the survey in 1910, maybe I ought to go back to 1880. I read the first annual report the other day, and I found that the first appropriation was for $100,000, and to help me Moses, they only spent 80. Now, King, of course, was the boss, but there were 9 geologists and 7 assistant geologists. Now, soon after the swarm, they entered 1330 F Street, which is known as the whole iron building. If time permitted and it doesn't, I'd like to tell you a lot about the whole iron building. Because it was a 4-story building, you entered up some stone steps, and then the ceilings were 16 feet high on the first floor, 12 feet high on the second, 8 feet high on the third, and about 6 feet high on the fourth. Now let's jump from 1880 to 1910, 30 years. You now find the appropriation is $1.5 million. And have 74 professional employees in the geologic branch. Now, the thing that I thought might amuse you, they occupied exactly the same space that the original crop in 1880 did. And they accommodated you by simply subdivisions. Whether they just as new. Maybe they do this in family life, I don't know, but you just subdivide the house as the kids come along. But anyhow, they just kept subdividing, and Adolph was on the third floor, I was on the fourth, and if I wanted to see Adolph, I almost needed a guide, because it was a labyrinth. That famous third floor was the most fantastic labyrinth. Anyhow, I want to mention briefly that 1330 S Street because our memories all start there. Now, you probably heard what's now known as the General Services Building began, was re-entered in May 1917. Soon after I arrived on the scene, George Otis began to talk about a new building for the survey. At least 5 or 6 years before he moved over there, and the theory was the survey, just as it is right now in Washington, the survey is supposed to get a new building. Well, that occurred down here with this building, four-story building, and the court in the rear, and all of the engraving and printing was back in a separate building. And there was about a big fire back there every year. And we, in the Pick and Hammer Show, we took George Otis off and wanted to know how he happened to set those fires. Because that was come on stuff so as to get the new building. Yeah. Well, now we're up to 1910. And I want to talk about briefly, between 10 and 15, maybe a few more men, that I came to know at that time. I arrived in 1911. Perhaps I might confess to you, I'll tell you why I went to the survey. I graduated in 1902 as a mining engineer. And somebody had the nerve to employ me as a mining engineer. And as I worked at it, I became impressed that I was more interested in geology and mining districts than I was in mining. So, I married, went to Haven in 1909, joined the survey. And I joined why? Because I wanted to do mining district work the way the survey did it. Now, what I didn't know, and this I might say is the theme of what I shall say in the next few minutes, the bunch of men that I was going to know. It's like a lot of things in life. Life is a curious mixture of planning and luck. Mayo may recall old Bill Shakespeare, make Hamlet say at one time, there is destiny that shapes our ends, rough use them as we will. Well, I tried to rough use something, but luck, good God, I've been lucky as hell. I thought I was smart and married Mary. But actually, I was lucky as hell. What I'm trying to bring out is simply that I had a purpose in going to Washington to survey, and I didn't know the men I was going to know and associate with, and that's the theme of what I shall say. The first person, member of the survey that I met, was James Spur, by a curious twist in 1905. I went to Peru, bumped into a vanadium deposit down there. And by that time, I knew that W.F. Hillebrand was a chemist. And as soon as I got back in the spring of 1906, I wrote Mr. Hillebrand, would he be interested in looking at these vanadium minerals? So very kindly, he took over the whole chore of analyzing these minerals. And out of it came, I think, 10 new minerals. So I met Spur in 1905 and met Hillebrand in 1906. And in 1909 we go to Haven, in 1911 to the survey, and here we are. Now, I'm going to read down the list of names from the oldest to the youngest, to probably about 25, and then make a few comments on these men. Of course, it would be presumptuous if I were to attempt to make an appraisal of these men professionally. Some of them I might. God knows I wouldn't want to try to appraise T.W. Wong. And yet I came to know him very well. In other words, I'm not going to presume to tell you what the professional things these men were. But I thought that you might be interested. in what kind of men they were, might say how they conducted themselves. They had the entire range. The Old South was so perfectly delightful men. George Becker was an old sourpuss. When I arrived, well, as of the year 1910, George Becker was 63 years old. And he was under what they called the Division of Chemistry and Physics. I had a notion one day, and God knows how I got it, that I wanted to talk to Mr. Becker about something. So I went upstairs, fourth floor, knocked on his door, come in. And he had a casserole in his hand, on his desk in front of him. And I would reach over and pick up something and drop it there and then look at it. And I found that these were flakes of ivory soap. And then he dropped them in there, the damn flakes started to move around. Well, he was proving some principle. But that, I don't know what. But that was my only personal acquaintance with George F. Now, the next, Frank W. Clark. Frank Clark was 63, as of 1910. I had a very great advantage because years gone by I had been in public school in Washington with Mildred Clark, Frank Clark's daughter. And when we went to Washington, Mary and Mildred became very close friends. And that gave me what might be called an entree with Dr. Clark. You may recall the first edition of the Division of Chemistry came out in 1907, so that's pre-1910. But it went through, as you know, five editions and became a bestseller. He was curious. He had sideburns. Most of you would be impressed that he was a very sour individual, but actually he had a very keen sense of humor and very quick wit. And I recall this story on him. Someone said, "Oh, Clark, how's that chimerical society of yours?" And he says, "Why, it's fine. How's the notional academy?" thing that impressed me about Dr. Clark, I had certain personal claims with him, but it never seemed to me that Clark was hard at work. He'd been out in the library and he's browsing around in the shelves of the library. Well, was he working? How many papers did Dr. Clark write? You needn't guess because you'd be foolish. 293. In other words, he was an amazing human being. Perhaps I ought to say right here that in those days, this crowd of men I'm going to speak about, probably more came from Harvard than any other college. Another good part came from Hopkins. There were a couple from two or four from California, several from Chicago, the ones I'm going to speak about. But Harvard certainly started with a lot of men there, and the curious thing was that after 1908, when Phil Smith came, nobody came from Harvard to the survey until Phil Pecor in 39. Now, let's pass on to Dr. Hildebrand. He was 57 as of 1910. My ties with him were wholly through this vanadium business. I would rate him, first of all, as probably the best mineral rock chemist in the United States for his generation. Of course, he was basically a laboratory chemist, somewhat different from Clark. I don't think you could say that Hildebrand was so much of a research chemist as Clark was. Impressed me very quickly, Hildebrand was one of the kindest men I ever knew in my life. It's just inconceivable to me that Hildebrand ever made a harsh remark about anyone. Well, if he wasn't idled in those days, he only wrote 89 papers in the 60 active years. Now we come to Whitman's Cross. Whitman's Cross is 56. Now, he was short. He was about 5 feet four or five, but he was certainly a good mountain man. I know nothing about him in the field. Fortunately, we had, I might say, some social intimacy, Mary and Mrs. Cross. Cross was probably the wealthiest man in the survey. Very, very well to do. And he had a beautiful house up on Bancroft Place. And it was Clark who started the Trousers Club about 1912. And Clark, the whole of the floor of his house, which was about four times the size of this room, was just lined with bookshelves. He had probably the best personal library of any of the crowd in the city of Washington, and maybe in many places. Well, it was Clark who started the Trousers Club, aided and abetted by others. Innings was there then, Henry Washington. And of course, I think the quantitative system first started way back in 1924. The evidence that we're still afloat at the meetings of the Trousers Club. So we met every month up in Clark's attic, we would call it. And to me, it was filled with pleasant memories. I'll mention only one item. Henry Washington liked his liquor. And he had been married, but he was unmarried at the time. Very close to Cross. Anyhow, it was very obvious many times that he liked his liquor. He comes to the meeting of the Trousers Club, and something calls upon him to comment on something. And he always smoked cigars. And he delivered a very impassioned discussion of the paper, emphasizing it with a cigar. Now I tell you, you cannot simulate in a crucible put down in the hills. And he cannot with a cigar. Well, the reason I dwell on this, this is a terribly funny episode, and Lawson watched this thing, and Lawson impersonated him at the next Pick Hammer show. Perfect. Most perfect impersonation. Well, I wanted to simply identify Cross as a private sub and the quantitative system. Now we come to E.O. Rory. He was 53. He had been married. I think he lost his wife, but he was a bachelor through most of his late life. He married again late. Now, I don't have to tell you, first, Ulrich was regarded as, might say, the final word in everything concerning the Paleozoic of the whole, certainly the eastern U.S. The whole Mississippi Valley, of course, adored him, worshipped him. He was something of a tyrant. He could be very harsh and contemptuous in discussion. The only thing that I will tie in my conduct to Ulrich concerns the year 1930. I had been working out in the West, lead and zinc, good springs, so I had some notions from that country of what might be called structural control. Well, in 1930, Lawson decided he was head of another section to put a man in the Appalachian lead zinc. He got Luke Currier. And then he told me that he wanted me to introduce Luke Currier into Appalachian lead and zinc. Well, I didn't know any history as far as Ulrich was concerned down there, except that he was a stinker for his paleontologist. Well, of course, this was Lou's job. I was just on the side. But anyhow, Lou gave a paper in which, you might say, following some of my notions, he said that the breccias in which the ore occurred were tectonic breccias. And Ulrich rose like a shot lion. And he was utterly contemptuous. He said that those things have nothing to do with structure. They're collapsed breccias, solution collapse. Well, this was so sharp that somebody decided There was a little meeting of the Geological Society to the problem of the controls of the Tennessee, Virginia, Red Sea. And we had one good big full session, about 30, well, five. Now, what I didn't know was that Joe Bridge, who was, I'd say, a disciple of Ulrich, had been working in there for several years on a stiggery. Joe came from Missouri, and he was one of the Missouri crowd that idolized Ulrich. Well, it turned out that this meeting, which was a paper given by Courier on the one hand, me in the rear, the opposite by Joe Bridge with Ulrich in the rear. Well, it was quite a show. Some years later, Ulrich had died. I said, Joe, did you ever see the light on those big deposits down there? I said, you remember all that stuff back in the mid-30s? He says, Foster, I knew you were right, but he said, if I had ever admitted it, Ulrich would have killed me. Well, now we come to Hayes and Camel. They were a pair, of course, 52. Hayes left the summer of 1911 to go to Mexico. I scarcely knew Hayes. When I was appointed with my business to go and greet the chief geologist, which I did. But I did have a lot to do with Camel in later years. Camel was afflicted with asthma, and it greatly curtailed his activities in late years. I should have told you about Ulrich. Ulrich only wrote 46 papers. But when it comes to Hayes, Hayes wrote 97. Now we'll pass on to Stanton. I can tell you quite a bit about Dr. Stanton. He was probably longer head of a section of Taylor Thompson's figure than any other man. I happen to know him rather well because he was one of the first to visit me out in Wyoming. I won't get involved in reminiscence about that. It was a very funny episode. Mary and Dr. Stanton, a horse ranger by the name of Bert Wilson, and I spent a week of dry camp in the Bighorn Basin. It was an awful lot of fun. Dr. Stanton was very moral. He was a pillar of the church. Bert was utterly unscrupulous horse trader. In the long summer evenings as we sat in camp there, Bert would spin out his horse trading yarn. And Dr. Stanton very quietly said, Mr. Wilson, when you put over a deal like that, doesn't your conscience ever hurt you? And he said, look here, Doc, I ain't never done nothing to anybody that I wouldn't be willing to have them do to me. Now, if he won't stand what I will, that's his lookout. Well, that's my passing comment to Dr. Stanton. Now, he comes to Lindgren. Lindgren was 50. I think, in speaking of Lindgren, I include Ransom. To me, they were almost an incredible pair of men. The records of both of them in work and production was magnificent. Lindgren only wrote 205 papers, not to mention books. Ransom only wrote 103. But anyhow, the thing that I'd like to say, I knew Johnson much better in later years than I ever knew Lindgren. Lindgren's volume, I could give it to you in pages or whatever, professional papers and folios and so forth. But Lindgren's record by numbers of publications was about half of Johnson's. But Lindgren was the most prolific in ideas. And to me, and maybe you, Lindgren influenced thought for 30, 40 years, and still does for that matter, through, well, I'll say, work and good imagination and industry. Branson did not contribute much in the way of, I would say, ideas. But his work was, to me, as where I crossed it, was fantastically accurate. And I would simply say the two were most extraordinary men, and yet not quite the like. Branson simply did his stuff with regularity. When I mention Ransom, I think I ought to say this. In the old days, this was as in this period, 1910, the director got $6,000, the chief yard was $4,000, and the elder just $3,000. Well, Ransom married, raised 4 kids, bought 2 houses in 25 years, and yet on $3,000 a year. Now, I might tell you a little story. First of all, he was a craftsman. He built a beautiful boat of mahogany in his own backyard in Washington. We used to take it down the river. When he came to California, Caltech, 26, he built another one down south. But the thing I think I mentioned about Ransom, first he was British born, and very British. I would say he was certainly normally unapproachable, very hard to approach. And he was like a lot of men who have become students of the art of expression, who are inclined to be sharp in comment. And Branson's criticism could be the sharpest things that I ever read. Now, I think that, of course, as you probably know, he died rather early. He died 63 or 4, 1935, I guess it was. Anyhow, I want to pay very high tribute to my, I might say, benefits derived from Ransom. Now we come to an amazing man, David White, 48. David White, up in New York, born in New York, went to Cornell. Very quickly got interested in botany, and actually his first job on the survey was drafting, drawing pictures of fossil plants. Well, I turned up in 1911 and somewhat quickly came in contact with Mr. White. The first war came along. White became chief geologist in 1912. The war was started in Europe in 14. I might mention this because it might interest you. The war started with a survey, the first war, in 17. The man who started it was W.O. Hotchkiss of Wisconsin. Hotchkiss was state geologist. And Hotchkiss thought there was a place for geologists during the war. We're not yet in the war. That led to the creation of what became known as the War Medals Committee. And on that committee were 4 men. Hotchkiss, representing the state geologist, a mining engineer from New York, the name of Westervelt, David White, and an economist from Euromine named A.D. White. Now, what the survey did during that first war arose primarily out of that committee, which was formed in 1916, and there began my personal contact with Mr. White. I could string this out quite a bit, because I came to know him pretty well. First, he was one of the kindest men I ever knew. It was rare to see what might be called a stern look. He was a tall man, 6'2". In fact, he always ran up the back stairs. He'd go to the museum, come over the back stairs on the ground floor, and then run up. And that brought it up to his stroke that finally killed him. Well, the thing that I wanted to emphasize about David White, first, he had an amazingly productive record. He only wrote 209 pages. But the thing that I would emphasize was the man's versatility. He had a splendid mind, And why was a paleobotanist whose culture was regarded especially, he could turn to various fields with almost brilliance. And I think that if our contribution to the war amounted to anything, it arose out of David White. Let me mention, in 12 years that David White was chief geologist, his door was never closed unless he had someone in there in a conference. And it was not uncommon for anybody down the fourth floor to go down to Mr. White's office and be received. Well, of course, that era has passed a long time ago. I go to Washington, it would take me 3 days to make a date with Bill Bradley. But anyhow, this brings on one another aspect of the war. It had a lot of first war I'm talking about, of course. The war sneaked up on us, of course, 14, 15, 16. We were drawn in April 6, 1917. Well, there was a lot of concern around the office of what a geologist did during the war. And we all met, oh, I don't know, 300-400 over in the museum building. And the topic was, what does a geologist do in the war? Well, Brooks had solved that problem because Brooks, back prior to 1516, they had established one of those officers' training camps in Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia. Brooks went to this camp with Sidney Page, Harry Ferguson, and Fred Hunter. So when the war struck, Brooks knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he quit the survey, went into the Army, and so forth. Became a major, finally lieutenant colonel. Now, the reason I'm drawing on this is that the war had some very curious consequences, because Lindgren had quit, Ransom was head of the metal section, and I would say a very effective man. At that meeting over in the museum, when called upon, Ransom said he didn't know what a geologist could do during the war except carry a musket. Well, that had some fatal consequences, because George Otis and David White had very definite notions about these things. And what they did, I have to say Mr. White did, was to carve out of Ransom's metal section all the ferrous metals, and it broke his heart. I don't know whether Adolf would agree with this. He knew Ransom much better than I. But from then on, Ransom was a changed man toward the survey. Because first of all, these ferrous metals were given to Burchard, for whom Ransom had a contempt. And of course, what happened later was he first went to Arizona in 24 and then to Caltech. But I thought, in fact, the war had some furious consequences like that. Incidentally, that's where I got my initiation into manganese. Well, I'm looking for a place to end this. I could talk about Vaughan. Vaughan's record of production was Clark's was the highest. Vaughan only wrote, Vaughan's record, 357. David White's was 209. F.W. Clark, 293. I'm reminded of looking at these figures. Probably heard the old gag, the rooster was walking around the barnyard and had to bump into an ostrich egg. He went over and got the hen and he says, come over here. I'm not complaining, he says, but you know, I just want to show you what other people are doing. Well, I could go on to all of them. Here's a crop of seven of them that were all born in 1871, therefore there were 39 in 1910. Alden, Alfred Brooks, Frank Hess, W.C. Munnall, Pardee, and George Otis Smith, and Arthur Spencer. I'll dwell briefly on George Otis Smith. Born in 71, graduated Colby College, Maine, went to Hopkins, came on the survey. Frank knows a lot more about George Otis than I do. Well, he became director at the age of 36. I came to know him through the war, and I might say post-war. He was kind enough to include me among those that he used to send his
speeches. I'm not going to try to appraise the directors for you, but I would rate George Otis very highly. He may not have been, I'll say, the dread of a broad gauge scientist, but he had what I would call, first of all, confidence and maybe some vanity, but presence. And he was greatly in demand for giving talks around the country. He gave an average of 4 or 5 talks a year, and I recently had to stack that high. Now, the reason I dwell on this is he wrote every one of those speeches himself. And if you don't know it, I'll tell you that's not the custom in Washington today. George Otis wrote every speech, and he was versatile. He had very strong and very, I think, very high ideas about many things. The art of writing. He had ideas on a great many subjects. But anyhow, he wrote these speeches himself, and then he'd send them around to 4 or 6 people to criticize them. And to my good fortune, for the next 10 years, to become one of his critics, which I was always very grateful. But I won't go into the details, but I can tell you that a recent director rarely wrote any speech that he gave. Now, Mendenhall never gave but 2 speeches in 13 years he was director. He was given a degree at the Colorado School of Mines when he had to make a speech. Next, he was president of the Geological Society of America, and he had to make a speech. And those are the only 2 times in 13 years that Mendenhall ever spoke outside. I think I better taper this off. Now, would you indulge me in just a few what I would call remarks in retrospect? Looking back, certainly pre-war, and I would say pre-New Deal, the survey has always been extremely, compared to federal bureaus, autonomous. I would say that certainly the era from 90 to 1930, the survey was highly autonomous. And not until the New Deal came to town did they stick their fingers in the machinery. And brother, did they. If you've never heard it, I'll tell you this. The New Deal came to town in 1933. And straight through the geologic branch, no matter what you were doing, up to that, the arrival of Mr. Ickes, you stopped and did something else. Charles is going to remember some of this stuff. But that was fundamental. Why? They cut our appropriations, and then to get money, you had to go on hands and knees and get it from WPA, and then they told you what to do. So that the autonomy began to pass as of the New Deal in 1933. I'll let that pass. But anyhow, we were highly autonomous in the old days. The secretaries, of course, I could dwell on some of them. I knew some of them. I would rate Mr. Wilbur here. He's probably the best secretary we have ever had. And he had one of the biggest assets afloat in the U.S., Hubert Wirt. He was a veterinarian from Pueblo, Colorado. And he was Secretary of the Interior under Hardin. Oh, God. The thing that I would emphasize in looking at this bunch of men is that there were, I would say, dedicated scientists. And men with a high order of integrity. Maybe you say, well, he's just another role. He's showing signs of senility because he just simply gets sloppy. But I would say if you take them for their work, their product, and their influence throughout the profession, I could draw on a number of things which, well, for instance, of these 23 men whose names I have on the list here, 11 either were or became members of the National Academy. Let me refer to something else. You remember this American Men of Science? Started in 1907 by J. McKean Cattell up at Columbia. And he quickly got the notion he wanted to know something about the varmints called scientists. So that you gave him the biographies, and then he speculated as to how these what were the favorable grounds for the growth of these worms? And then came the idea that they would star the eminent scientists. Well, this had a whole lot of very funny consequences. But the thing that I got interested in statistics back in the 20s. And as of the complement on the survey, the geologists of the survey has 10 to 20, and in fact up to 30. 40-odd percent were always starred in the American Men of Science. Well, I take that as a measure of the esteem in which these men were held by their contraries. Well, now, maybe I ought to terminate this. What do we got now? We've got about 1,200, haven't we, in the geologic division, which is, let's say, roughly 10 or more times what there were in 1920. Size is a terrible ordeal. I won't try to sketch to you how you grow in size, but size inevitably means diversification. And diversification means that, after all, contacts begin to shrink. You can't know more than so many people. I would pay high tribute to the intimacy that we had as a group there when the personnel were 75 to 100, and I personally will pay high tribute for the benefits I derived from knowing somewhat intimately men in 15 branches of the science. And that's very difficult these days. Very difficult. Now, this may be the place to terminate these remarks, but you've been very indulgent. Now, I'm going to ask Adolf to carry on with some reminiscence of his own.